The sun rises on the last day of this Denko A session. Studying these stories of the ancient ancestors. Meanwhile, our mind, our awareness, like a great round mirror with no boundaries or edges, receiving each reflection equally. Those painful legs and back reflections in the mirror, that restless mind and distracted thoughts, reflections in the mirror, so alluring, especially when the pain builds and the thoughts become very strong. So how can we trust the mirror and trust ourselves to the mirror and surrender to the mirror that can't be seen, that can't be gotten hold of, that's not doing anything, but is radiantly shining like thousands of suns and moons all at once. Always right here, never hidden, and yet the reflections are so enticing, inviting us to trust them. Do something about them. And even the problem maker himself or herself, our special friend, is himself a reflection on the surface of the mirror. Not just the problems. Problems are surely reflections on the mirror, but the problem maker is also a reflection. Therefore, we can receive her graciously, like a mirror. The mirror would never say, I'll receive breakfast and lunch and a cool breeze and even painful legs and wandering thoughts. Okay, I can receive. But the problem maker himself, I don't know if I can receive that one. The mirror, our mirror, doesn't say that. But I might say that. Therefore, the problem maker is really our close friend. Dancing joyfully across the surface of the mirror. I love him. He's a sweet old friend. you mean? No, really, it's okay. He can be here. Yes.
Who is the one welcoming
the mirror? Is that one that we might even say is always actually welcoming, never misses an invitation, but then there's some others who kind of like hijack the invitation. Like the invitation's in the mailbox already, but then some other habitual tendencies come and they actually like kind of break into the mailbox and rummage through the mail, like, and like, oh, there's an invitation to like breakfast and lunch and the cool breeze, nice. Even then, oh, but what's this one? A stamped invitation to the problem maker, inviting him for tea. I think actually this one we don't need. Yeah, so it's not even really that. I mean, in this sense, it's not even so much that it's a practice of like, I'm gonna really welcome the problem maker. It's more like there's already somebody who is welcoming meaning just like fully receiving, like a mirror, fully embracing, not averse to the troublemaker. And so it's just trying to keep an eye on these hijackers, the mailbox thieves. These old stories, I mean, that's what we're doing in this Denko A Sesshin, is bringing up the ancient Zen stories. And you might wonder sometimes if they're like pertinent and relevant to our life. And, you know, don't tell anyone, but I might wonder that too. Sometimes. Especially don't tell Fuyo Dokai. I think that sometimes they sound so lofty, and I think they're in the context of larger relationships where there's a lot of day-to-day conversations between these teachers and students about how to proceed with their lives, and these are just little excerpts about these pinnacle moments of turning. How we apply them is one of the great points here. And just like Keizan doesn't explain that all for us, he's leaving up to us that work. So sometimes there's maybe a kind of a leap of interpretation that is required of us. Maybe we can keep that in mind through today's story. It also brings up questions for me about the old tradition, and you know, so much loving care going into creating the sutras and the commentaries and the Zen records, practitioners working so hard in the past to convey something to us, and they don't make it that easy. Sometimes it's easier than others. I've heard one story that The Lotus Sutra became like maybe one of the most important sutras in East Asia because it was kind of accessible. It's still kind of a strange and unusual sutra, but there's some great metaphor. There's a lot of parables and metaphors about skillful means, and the East Asian people could understand and apply them. Whereas then we have sutras like the Sandinamochana Sutra, or the Lankavatara Sutra even, that was kind of connected with Zen, that are actually all kinds of Abhidharma mind stuff and intricacies of how things work. Never very popular, actually. Nothing like the Lotus Sutra. So, we might ask about this Denko Roku, old transmission of light. Is it a antiquated relic that should be honored as an ancestral record by maybe just like putting it on the altar and bowing to it, but maybe opening it's a little too much. Like I've brought up before, a friend of mine, Karl Brunholzl, German scholar, practitioner in Tibetan tradition, who he's a teacher for me. I've received various teachings. A brilliant mind, and he did this whole classical training in Tibetan Buddhism, kind of study training. Maybe the first Western Kenpo is this term. It's like a PhD, but maybe like a super advanced PhD in certain Tibetan traditions. So that meant like really fluently learning Tibetan, going through all kinds of debate with teachers after thoroughly learning the text to clarify the finer points, living over in those countries for decades, I think. And then he's this treasure house, and then come back to America, actually. And with one of his Tibetan teachers started a place called Nalanda Bodhi, like the awakening from Nalanda University, the great Indian Buddhist university where Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu and Shantideva all practiced, and thriving community of I think meditation practice and great learning, and bringing out classic teachings, commenting on them, creating new classic teachings. So the Center for Practice and Learning in Washington State, they created together, and have offered a really rigorous kind of study program. And my partner Shoho, who's living in Kathmandu, ran into him the other day. He was passing through town there to visit one of his other Tibetan teachers who's getting very old and won't live much longer. I think they met there. Shoho was visiting that teacher also. And they went out to lunch, and he was telling her that he feels kind of like a Buddhist dinosaur, I think was his words. Maybe meaning like about to go extinct. he said, you know, we started this place and you know, it had a certain direction, but actually not so many people are into like that kind of thoroughness of ancient teaching. I mean, it takes a lot of work to even begin to understand it. And Carl with his great devotion and effort. You might drop your jaw. I drop my jaw when I look at these books he's translated and created. Like about like this thick with like super fine print, and like half the book is footnotes. That's the kind of guy he is. on some pretty obscure Indian texts that are super important in Tibetan tradition, but for American practitioners, it's like people don't even read this stuff. They don't even know it exists often. Like the Abhisamayalamkara by the great Maitreya and Asanga, the Yogacara founders, is like, it's so dry and dense that his teacher asked him, like, I think this is such an important text, I think, can you please translate it? Maybe nobody else can do this in a really thorough way with all its commentaries and footnotes also. And he was like, oh, really? That one? You know, he had studied it a lot, but, and you know, I don't know how many years it took him to do that. It's actually 3 volumes, like about this thick. Because it's like, not just the root text, but like a lot of the traditional Tibetan commentaries going through the whole thing, and then his own commentaries, and then all the footnotes. You know. I haven't made it through the first volume yet. Working on it a little bit. How many people will read these things ever in this country, you know? It's a small audience, I think. But he says the group that he and his teacher started there, it's, you know, people that are, they're trying to, I think, support it in different ways, and there's a lot of energy around fundraising and I think trying to make it accessible, and you know, the people are taking it in different directions, and he feels like, I think that, you know, this whole thing that keeps getting passed on in the Asian countries is like, I don't know if this is gonna ever happen in America, if this is gonna actually work. And as a dinosaur about to go extinct, I feel like he's such a treasure house. But I think these are questions about Buddhism in America now, right? Like, you know, are we gonna, how far do we want to go? And in Zen especially, I think it's like, it's not such a scholarly tradition. So how far do we want to go, in the practice aspect, in the meditative aspects? And though it's not a scholarly tradition, there's been Zen scholar practitioners, maybe not since the beginning, maybe not in the golden age of Zen, but by the Sung dynasty, the ones who collected all the commentaries on the Koan collections and so on, and Dogen and Kazan. Dogen especially is considered like a kind of scholar, but maybe secondarily to his devotion to just wholeheartedly sitting without need for reciting sutras and incense offering, bowing and repentance. So on the last day of this dusty old ancient text, I just, those thoughts arise, like, I wonder about this. Yes.
When I was practicing in Japan and Zen Monsoto, I don't think it was maybe once a year, they took out all the sutra books, and they're about this size, and they're accordion style, and they go like this, instead of reading them. And they go through all the books. It was fun doing it.
Yeah, for the New Year's time, often.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. The huge, you know, large Prajnaparamita Sutra is like, no one's ever going to read all that. But we honor the sutra. Yeah. So we that's the way we read it.
Right.
Is the characters, when you fan it out like that, can fly off the page and spread around the world and inconceivably enter the mind streams of all beings, infusing them with great perfect wisdom. It could be that that's a particular Zen thing too, that maybe there's other schools like, what are you talking about? Page by page, we got to read it. But the Zen people are like, we don't have time because we have to go to Zazen. Yeah. Old teachings, and are they relevant and useful? So, it's a question for me. Maybe a question for you, too. And so, as we proceed, if we feel like this isn't so relevant, maybe there's also a spirit kind of like Ellen just brought up. Finding these sutras is kind of like devotion to those sutras. It's like we don't just say, well, just leave them on the shelf. It's like we know there's, we feel there's something important here. We honor this, that that part of the tradition. So it's a, we do a devotional ritual to celebrate those sutras. So if you start to get lost today in the Kazon's story, this could be a way to treat this. I'm just listening to this as a devotional practice. I'm not actually trying to get anything out of it or learn anything here. I'm just receiving these strange stories at like reflections on the surface of this vast mirror, out of devotion to the ancients who brought us, who got us here. They did. Without Kazon and all the ancestors he's talking about, I mean, from a certain perspective, if any one of them was missing, we wouldn't be here in this room right now. Maybe somebody else would have been there and it would be different, right? But in that way, we're devoted to them. And it could be our job now. We find ourselves here due to them. It may be our job to leap beyond them, to leap beyond that way of talking. Make this most relevant and beneficial to all beings. Maybe means, like some of the Zen ancestors did, burning all the sutras and commentaries and then going up and just to some mountaintop and sweeping the ancestors' memorial, just taking care of everyday activity. And one day, a pebble from our broom might hit a piece of bamboo and go, so, Kazon's most known for his transmission of light record, Denko Roku. Maybe secondly, he's known for the Zazen Yojinki. What to be aware of in Zazen. And I think this was inspired by Dogen's Fukan Zazengi that we chanted this morning. He takes a lot of pieces of the Fukan Zazengi and puts them into his own, just like Dogen took pieces of earlier Chinese Zazen instructions and put them into his Fukan Zazengi. I think Ellen gave me a translation of this,
oh, yeah,
like maybe a year ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got it when I was at CCLA.
Yeah, old one from Maizumi Roshi.
Yeah.
Or, he probably translated.
I guess. Yeah,
yeah.
No, but I know I got it when I was at UCLA, so that would be like 1980.
Yeah, so it's one of those classic texts that we don't talk about much, I think, in America, partly because the Fukan Zazengi is shorter and more concise and direct in its Dogen. But Keizan, you know, it's not, it's maybe four times as long. It's not super long. But here's just a little bit of it. Keizan Zazen instructions. Sitting is the way to clarify the ground of experience and rest at ease in your true nature. This is called the display of the original face and revealing the landscape of the basic ground. Drop off body and mind, and you will be far beyond such forms as sitting or lying down. Beyond considerations of good or bad, transcend any divisions between common people and sages, pass beyond the boundary between sentient beings and Buddha. Putting aside all concerns, shed all attachments, do nothing at all. Do nothing at all. Don't fabricate any things with the six senses. Who is this? Its name is unknown. It can't be called body. It can't be called mind. Trying to think of it, the thought vanishes. Trying to speak of it, words die. It's like a fool, like an idiot. It's as high as a mountain, deep as the ocean. Without peak or depths, its brilliance is unthinkable. It shows itself silently. Between sky and earth, only this whole body is seen. And let's see, let's skip around a little bit. Just mind, just body. Difference and sameness miss the point. The mind is like the ocean waters, the body like the waves. There's no waves without water and no water without waves. Water and waves not separate, motion and stillness not different. So it is said, a person comes and goes, lives and dies, as the imperishable body of the four elements and five aggregates. There's a Zen story about this. If you take it literally, it's totally heretical. The imperishable body of the five aggregates. But in Zen, this is pointing to that. One, the Buddha said, listening and thinking about it are like being shut out by a door. Zazen is like coming home and sitting at ease. How true. And then he has a lot of practical instructions that Dogen doesn't include, like, although we shouldn't be too anxious about bodily comforts, inadequate clothing, food, and sleep are known as the three insufficiencies and will cause our practice to suffer.
Sleep.
Insufficient sleep will cause our practice to suffer. You might have noticed. And also, just before the tenzo goes, she should know Keizan's instructions. Don't eat anything alive, hard, or spoiled. Such impure foods will make your body churn. Please carry on.
Well, in Japan, I think they eat live goldfish.
Oh. You should eat to promote life, so don't fuss about taste. Also, if you eat if you sit right after eating too much, you'll feel ill. Whether the meal is large or small, wait a little while before sitting. That's why we have breaks after meals. Generally, anything that wears out body and mind causes illness. Although large Buddhist ceremonies and the construction of large temples may be good things, one who's committed to practice shouldn't get involved. Sometimes we have to benefit others. Don't be fond of teaching Dharma, as this leads to distraction and scattering. I personally have noticed this. This sesshin especially, because all my breaks are like going back to Kaizen. There's no like just rest. Don't try to study and practice too many different things. Don't sit where it's too bright or too dark, too cold or too hot. Sometimes it can't be helped. Wash your eyes and feet. Keep the body and mind at ease and deportment in harmony. And then, you might have heard this before. I may have brought this up in the past. But I think these are some really practical instructions about if dullness or sleepiness overcome your sitting,
open the window.
Move the body and open the eyes wider. Might just mean like a wriggle or something. Or place attention at the hairline between your eyebrows. So I think these are some kind of yogic specific things that Dogen doesn't get quite into, but place your attention up. And these are another meditation text to raise if your attention's down in your dantian, which is often recommended in the lower abdomen. If you're sleepy, like raise your attention up to like your kind of third eye brightness.
Sometimes looking up helps.
Yeah, looking up. He might even say that too. But yeah, like if your eyes are open looking down, raise your gaze up the wall a little bit. And yeah, it's about raising energy. I think these things are interesting to practice with. If you're still not fresh, rub the eyes or the body. If that still doesn't wake you, stand up and walk. Always clockwise. Once you've gone about 100 steps, you probably won't be sleepy any longer. But sometimes it's not kinhin yet. Maybe in these old days it was like, it just, you do kinhin when you want. And we could say, if you want, the rest of sesshin, if you're feeling really sleepy, you can just quietly do kinhin. Sometimes we've done that at Tassajara. The way to walk, of course, is to take a half step with each breath. Walk without walking. silent and unmoving. If you still don't feel fresh after kinyin, wash your eyes and forehead with cold water, or chant the three pure precepts of bodhisattvas. Do something. Don't just fall asleep. You should be aware of the great matter of birth and death and the swiftness of impermanence. If dullness and sinking arise repeatedly, you can recite to yourself, habits are deeply rooted and I am wrapped in dullness. When will the dullness disperse? May the compassion of the Buddhas and ancestors lift this darkness and misery. So basically like pray for wakefulness. If the mind wanders, this is the other direction now. If the mind wanders, is agitated and restless, place attention at the tip of the nose and abdomen and count the inhalations and exhalations of breath. Now, I don't know about nose tip and abdomen. It sounds complicated. It might be a translation issue of like nose tip or abdomen. I think other traditions do follow the breath at the nostrils. Zen generally, it's like in the abdomen, which I think is good. I think my experience, when the mind's really scattered and dispersed, bring the breath down is very grounding and settling. And counting breaths, if you're not already, that's a good one. I don't always count breaths, but if the mind's really like running around, then I'm like, okay, come, like, rein it back in. One, two. Yeah. If that doesn't stop the scattering, bring up a phrase, the head of a koan, and keep it in awareness. For example, what is it that thus comes? Or like, what is the original face? Or when no thought arises, where is there any affliction? Mount Sumeru. Or what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? The cypress tree in the garden. Sayings like this, these simple, not some complex, long dialogue story, will get your mind even more scattered, but simple sayings like this that you can't draw any flavor out of are suitable. Which I think a lot of those koans are about, just like very directly just cutting off any like complications. What's the meaning of Bodhidharma has come from the West? And, you know, less than, 10 volumes, can you explain? The cypress tree in the garden. It's kind of like cuts off the distracted mind.
The sound of one hand clapping.
The sound of one hand, yes. Yeah. Does a dog have Buddha nature? No! If scattering mind continues, sit and look to that point where the breath ends and the eyes close forever, where the child is not yet conceived, where not a single concept can be produced, when a sense of the emptiness of self and phenomena appears, scattering will surely rest. Arising from stillness of zazen, carry out activities without hesitation. This moment is actualizing the fundamental point. When practice and realization are without complexity, then the fundamental point is actualized. That which is before any trace arises, the scenery on the other side of the empty eon, the activity of all Buddhas and ancestors is just this one thing. Just rest and cease. Be cooled. Pass numberless years as this moment. Be cold ashes, a withered tree, an incense burner, and an abandoned temple, a piece of unstained silk. This is my earnest wish. So, you can read the full version some other time if you wish. Now, since Stan came back, he asked earlier about, we were talking about Kazon's women disciples. And we looked into it a little bit more, but then he disappeared. So I've been bringing this along in case you came back. We talked about this already, but just to review. The women ancestors that we chant in the morning, there's eight in a row, three of which are Dogen students. So Acharya Ryonen, Acharya Shogaku, and Acharya Egi are Dogen's women students, ordained. Shogaku was ordained by Dogen, and she was also the donor that supported Koshoji, Dogen's first temple. And Ryonen and Egi were ordained in the Darumashu, which is this other school, you know, Darumashu. That was this kind of a little bit renegade Zen movement going on at Dogen's time, that antinomian, I sometimes say. Like, they were really into, like, not doing anything about anything, so their practice wasn't so strong. And they kind of discovered Dogen and his teachings, and a lot of people kind of, like, moved from the Daruma, which is the Bodhidharma school, to Dogen's practice, including Kōen Ejo, started with this Daruma school. So then the next five are all Kazan's women students. Acharya Eikan is Kazan's mother. And you asked if they were abbots at temples. So Hōji, a women's temple was built in her honor. I think she did, she became a priest when Kazan was very young, actually, and so kind of didn't practice with Kazan, but was an inspiration. Acharya Mokufu Soni, let's see, the next one is Acharya Shōzen, is Mokufu Sonin's mother. And Acharya Mokufu Sonin is Shōzen's daughter. And they were both ordained by Kazan. And Mokufu Sonin was, I told the story about, she and her husband were very wealthy, and they were the donor of Yokoji, Kazan's main temple. And then Mokufu Sonin became the first abbot of Ensu-in, which was next to Yokoji on the same land, a women's temple. And Acharya Ikkyu is came from practicing elsewhere, practiced with Kazan, and she was the first Soto Zen woman ancestor. In other words, received Dharma transmission from Kazan. Acharya Ekyu is kind of special in that way.
Do you know if any of the women passed on transmission to men?
I don't know. Yeah.
I would be surprised if they had.
Yeah, but maybe, because we do have some stories like that in Chinese Zen as well as Japanese Zen. It's some of those women ancestors that we chant, that some of the Chinese ones actually did have actually a lineage continued after them with men.
Wow.
So yeah, so it did happen. I think not so common. And but these particular students of Kazan, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, it should have been in the book that talked about this if it was true. And I think it didn't say much about what happened next, although also, and Acharya Myosho Enkan was Kazan's cousin, who also received transmission from Kazan. But there is something, there was something about the future after this time of Kazan's life, where in 1334, which was soon after this time, maybe the next generation or so, this group of nuns, women priests, formed the Sotoshu Nisodan. Niso means women priests association. Sotoshu Women's Priests Association in 1334. I was amazed. It's so early. That's like right at the time of Kazan. So there's this whole group. It said about 30 women priests practiced at Yokoji with Kazan. So there were a lot. And then later they formed this association, but it didn't survive.
Yeah. When did it die out?
It didn't say how long it lasted. I think it said maybe like not that long. And I think due to political conditions and the way things are in Asia often for women, until around 1900, when there was this kind of revival of Soto Zen women priests in Japan, and coming together, and now there are at least this one quite I mentioned quite active women's monastery, Soto Zen in Japan, and they might have an organization like this now. So it's like, you know, you can stop it for a while. Like a lot of these things go underground, like the Shobogenzo and the Denko Roku, for centuries and centuries, they were lost. And then just collecting dust. And then people discovered them again, and I think that's maybe a little bit like, of course, this, how are the, there were always women practicing, of course, but then have the support to come together and practice like that, it took a while. And now I think it will never end, because the world, I think, is changing too slowly, but it's gradually changing, even in Asia, to support women's practice. My main Tibetan teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, apart from teaching lots of Westerners Dzogchen practice and so on, his one of his big life missions is supporting women practitioners in both Tibet and Nepal. And because his predecessors, his past incarnations, that's what they were about in times when women weren't getting as much education. So he wants to create really, really deep, thriving practice communities for women, and it's working. It's amazing, especially in Tibet. Very, very rural areas of Tibet, yeah, where they, these yoginis are practicing like intensively in retreat and getting like really thorough education too, to pass it on to more women and more men. So I think the world is, you know, going this way. Slowly, slowly. May it continue. The 48th ancestor was Zen teacher Tien Tong Tsung Chue. Not to be confused with Tien Tong Ru Jing, Dogen's teacher, but they're both Tien Tong because they both practiced Mount Tiantong, Heavenly Child Monastery, which is an active practice place from long before this time up to today. I actually got to do a little like, almost like sesshin at Tiantong Monastery in China. And it wasn't so clear whether this was like a special event that they were doing or whether it was their daily practice. But, you know, a lot of Zen is definitely coming back in China, and they practice Zazen. But this place, Tiantong, this is where Dogen dropped off body and mind, right? They're like totally into Zazen. It was like a sesshin schedule. But a little more informal feeling, a little more like, I think China is a little more informal feeling than Japan in general, right? So it's like during Qinyin, and they do fast Qinyin. But they'd have Zazen Qinyin, Zazen Qinyin, Zazen Qinyin. And during Qinyin, the fast walking, it was like the bathroom break, but also they had like a kind of tea area, and the monks would all kind of like hang out and chat in the tea area. If we did that here, we might say, no. But that was what I mean by a little bit more informal. But it may be because it was like just their daily life.
How does that compare with the daily schedule at the Haji?
Very different, actually.
That's what
I wanted to say. Well, no, that partly that the daily schedule at Heiji is two periods of Zazen a day. So, Warm Jewel Temple in Santa Cruz, we do much more Zazen than Heiji. Even on a daily basis. It's not about Zazen there. They have a very full, elaborate schedule, but they don't emphasize Zazen. They emphasize, like, lots of ceremonies, like long. You think our morning service is long these days? They pull out all the stops.
Well, they meant to train the priests.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Right, it's like a ritual training. And they have sesshin, maybe even only one sesshin. I know they have Rohatsu sesshin, maybe that's the only one. And I think they might have these Genzo A sesshins. I don't know if current days, where it's like a kind of study sesshin of Dogen in his place. But yeah, so in some ways this revival in China is kind of going back to a kind of more authentic practice-based, Zazen practice-based life. It's very inspiring to practice with them.
And international too. I mean, students like.
I think me and my friend there were the only ones, you know, not Chinese. And there were, out of like hundreds of monks, it seemed like only one spoke like a little broken English. And he was like sort of guided us around, a young one. Yeah, Tiantong. It's so huge that I would get lost going from several times, after, even when I knew the way, going from like the room where I was staying to the Zendo. Like literally, like there's all these corridors and different like buildings and different levels and steps going up and down and all around and different things happening at the same time because it's so big and thriving. There's like, wow, the Zendo area had this sesshin thing going on, and then there was another hall where they're like continuously chanting and doing kind of like our Sejiki ceremony. They have this like super extended version that goes on for days that's like for the ancestors. Yeah, lots of music and costumes and mantras and offerings and people will sponsor the ceremonies for their deceased relatives on some special day. So it wasn't like everyone was doing the same thing. They're like the Zazen compound and then like elaborate ceremony compound. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, those kind of ceremonies are the Chinese Vajrayana influence. Yeah. So, So we have two ancestors named Chan Tong in our lineage because they both practiced at this monastery. The 48th Chan Tong Tsung Chie, or Tendo Sogaku Daiyosho, Sogaku Source Jewel, was Wu Kung's attendant, the Jisha, for a long time. Wu Kung's the previous 47th ancestor. One time, Wu Kung asked him, "How do you see things these days?" Or another translation is, "What's your view these days?" Tian Tong said, "Suppose I say, it is thus." This word, emo, that is like this Chinese colloquial expression that means like this, or thus, or such as this. It's a colloquial expression as opposed to like a Buddhist term, but referring to the Buddhist concept of suchness or thusness, things as. A Suzuki Roshi wonderfully says, "Things as it is." Yeah. You heard that one? Yeah. Things as, I think is, you know, you could say a translation of emo or suchness. And then somebody said, "Suzuki Roshi, in English we say, things as they are." And he said, no, I mean things as it is. Mm-hmm. So it's intentionally saying it that way, right? Things as it is, so great. For some, maybe it takes a multilingual person learning English to come up with something like that. Things as it is. So, how do you see things these days? Suppose I say, just things as it is, or thus, or another translation is, you. Suppose I say, I am like this. Translate it like that. So the teacher says, "That's not enough. Say some more." And Tian Tong says, "Why isn't that right?" And Wu Kung says, "I didn't say it wasn't right, but you aren't familiar yet with that which is beyond." Tian Tong said, "I can express that which is beyond." Wu Kung said, "What is that which is beyond?" Tian Tong said, "Even supposing that I can express that which is beyond, I cannot put it into words for you, teacher. Or I cannot bring it out for you, teacher." Wu Kung said, "Well, then you can't really express it." Tian Tong said, "I beg you to say it then, teacher." Wu Kung said, "Okay, ask me and I'll say it." Tian Tong said, "What is that which is beyond?" Wu Kung said, "Suppose I say, it's not thus." And Tian Tong was awakened when he heard this. And Wu Kung gave his seal of approval. So this is a bit longer story than the last few ancestors. They had to go back and forth a few times.
I had a few of these stories when then the teacher says or does something, and then it's reported that the student was awakened.
Mm-hmm.
So what did the student do or say, or, you know, fall on the ground, or
oh.
raise their eyebrows and blink?
Oh, to know, for the teacher to know, right?
Not literal enlightenment.
Yeah, it's a good question, especially in this case.
The teacher gave the answer.
Yeah, teacher gave the answer. And Yeah, sometimes they do something, right? Like they'll start crying, or they'll smile, or they'll bow,
or
they'll hit the teacher, and then now I know. But that's true. A lot of them were like.
They'll run away holding their ears.
Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah, or sometimes some of the ones that we've looked at this week, they don't say that the teacher approved right at that time. They just say they awakened. So it's more like later you find out that's, it's the report from that person. But so it may be that he gave his approval later. But it does say in this one, it's one of the few that says he gave his approval. Maybe the commentary will bring this out. But there does seem to be some non-described meetings where previously there were, like, the one who comes down from the mountain having awakened, and immediately, like, I guess he does bow to the teacher, but the teacher says, "Oh, I see that you understand it," or something. So maybe it's a different manner that's not described in the text. So, just to read the story again, in case you missed it. One day, Wu Kung, the teacher, asked, "How do you see things these days?" It's kind of like, let's prompt an awakening with a casual question. "How do you see things these days?" And the student said, "Suppose I say it's thus." Which is, I think some other translations don't say, "Suppose I say." So I don't know if there's something in there. It makes it sound very kind of casual and maybe a little bit non-committed too. "How do you see things these days?" Instead of "I am thus" or "it is thus," "suppose I say it's thus." How's that? "Suppose." "How do you see things these days?" "Suppose I say it's thus." Wu Kung said, "That's not enough. Say some more." Tian Tong said, "Why isn't it right?" Wu Kung said, "I didn't say it wasn't right. But you aren't yet familiar with that which is beyond." Tian Tong said, "I can express that which is beyond." This translation actually says, "I expressed that which is beyond." It's a little different. Wu Kung asked, "What is that which is beyond?" Tian Tong said, "Even supposing that I can express that which is beyond, I cannot put it into words for you." Or the other translation, "I cannot bring it out for you." Wu Kung said, You can't really express it." Tian Tong said, "I ask you to say it." Wu Kung said, "Ask me and I'll say it." "All right, what is that which is beyond?" Wu Kung said, "Suppose I say it's not thus." So, not so unfamiliar after these stories, these two sides, right? If he had said at first, "Suppose I say vast emptiness, not even thusness," probably the teacher would say, "Say more, that's not enough." And when he asked for his own response, he'd say, "It's thus." Maybe he would have said like that, but if one side is expressed, the other side needs to be also. So the Tian Tong's ordination name was Chung Chue, or Sogaku. He was Wu Kung's jisha attendant for a long time. He practiced unceasingly day and night in every possible way, so he seemed to be constantly ready. Wukong asked, "How do you see it these days?" And as the story went, and so on. Keizong actually does that, he says, and so on, as we just heard. So that's all we know about his life, according to this. Now, Keizan says, when Tsung Chie says, thus, or like this, emo, there is still something lacking. Even though he understands the so-called comes in this way, in quotes, or thus come, he did not know that there is one who does not thus come. The entirety being exposed and nothing concealed, he wondered what could be lacking. He asked, what's lacking? Those who understand it like this and can be like green mountains, lofty and solitary when the white clouds disperse, still do not realize that there is another mountain taller than that. One who can be like a solitary green peak when all the clouds disperse, the radiant, majestic mountain, by saying it's thus, which is actually like a majestic mountain when the clouds have scattered, but still they don't realize that there's another even taller mountain. Wukong therefore said, I didn't say what you said wasn't right, but you're not familiar with that which is beyond. Although practicing like this is itself that which is beyond, still, Sogaku made the mistake of not knowing its existence. Wukong said, you can't really express it. So, he does give him credit for practicing like this already is itself gone beyond. But he doesn't yet know that. So this beyond is a key thing here. Kojoji, in Japanese, Kojoji. So Dogen has an essay called Butsu Kojoji. Buddha, going beyond Buddha. Butsu Kojoji is the matter. Ji is like the great matter. So it's, and Kojo is like above, like transcending, going beyond. So the matter of going beyond is Kojoji. And Butsu Kojoji is the matter of going beyond Buddha. And this is, he does say, you aren't familiar with that which is gone beyond, or the matter that's gone beyond. You aren't familiar with the Kojoji. So in Butsu Kojoji of the Shobogenzo, which is a wonderful essay of Dogen, because it's his, Dogen's way of talking about what Buddha means is going beyond Buddha. So this phrase maybe first came from, or going beyond Buddha first came from, or was at least brought out in a lasting way by Dungshan. So I think that's why Dogen particularly praises this, because our ancestor Dungshan said it, brought out various phrases about going beyond Buddha, but one of them he says, Dungshan taught the assembly You should know someone going beyond Buddha. A monk asked, "Who is someone going beyond Buddha?" And Dungshan said, "Not Buddha." Which is kind of similar to this story at hand. You have to go beyond "it is thus." What's going beyond "it is thus"? It is not thus. In this case, there's someone going beyond Buddha. Who is that? Not Buddha. And Dogen says, the words of Dungshan do not mean that you should be someone who goes beyond Buddha. The words of Dungshan do not mean that you should be someone who goes beyond Buddha, or that you should meet someone who goes beyond Buddha. He just means that you should know that there is someone who goes beyond Buddha. Don't try to be it or know it. Just know there is someone who goes beyond Buddha. That one. The key to this barrier is not knowing someone who goes beyond Buddha and not knowing someone who goes beyond not Buddha. So this is Dogen on a roll now. Someone who goes beyond Buddha in this way is not Buddha. When you're asked, what is not Buddha, you should consider, you do not call him not Buddha because he precedes Buddha. You do not call him not Buddha because he follows Buddha. You do not call him not Buddha because he surpasses Buddha. He's not Buddha merely because he is.
Not
Buddha. Any other guesses?
Buddha.
Going beyond Buddha.
Reminds me of, you know, the great poetry you can write up with those refrigerator magnets. You know, they're all there, and you just, you know, keep scrambling them around until you find something that sounds nice. So this is him with all of the Japanese characters. Not, let's put it over here now.
Maybe that's how Dogen wrote the Shobogenzo, was with refrigerator magnets. Someday they'll discover in an ancient chest in the attic of a Heiji a box of old refrigerator magnets. About like 40 or 50% of them will be the characters for not. So, I think there is an interesting point here. What is not Buddha? You do not call him not Buddha because he precedes Buddha, something like before Buddha. You do not call him not Buddha because it follows Buddha. You don't call it not Buddha because it surpasses Buddha. It's not Buddha merely because it's going beyond Buddha. Not Buddha is so called because Buddha's face is dropped away. Buddha's body and mind are dropped away. So there's a whole fascicle on going beyond Buddha, but I thought that was a part for me that really stood out. What do we mean by going beyond Buddha? It means Buddha's face is dropped away, Buddha's body and mind are dropped away. What does that mean? How can he wash the dishes then? So, it's just, the body can keep washing the dishes and the mind can keep thinking about the dishes, but they're dropped away, and there's one who's gone beyond Buddha, dropped off, like if it seems like the reflections are actually starting to like stick onto the mirror, like refrigerator magnets, or something like that, then you could say dropping them off is like seeing that they're actually like not stuck to the mirror, but they still are reflected right in the same place and can function like that. Shall that be enough for the morning exploration of light? Precious Sashin. Periods rolling by. Next chance after today is Rohatsu in a couple months. So let's savor the freshness of this particular day. May all good merit gathered here invisibly and inconceivably be dispersed widely and evenly throughout the universe to touch all distraught beings with peace. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.